last week, something extraordinary happened behind closed Zoom doors. A direct meeting between Israeli Knesset members and Iranian opposition leaders. And it was organized by the Israeli member of Knesset, Dan Iluz, the Middle East Center and Or Torah Stones Interfaith Center. The meeting, behind closed doors, explored how to support the downfall of Iran's Ayatollah regime and rebuild the long-lost relationship between the Israeli and Iranian people. It's a bold, visionary step and one that could shift the Middle East's diplomatic landscape entirely. And joining me on the line to discuss this meeting is Aharon Ariel Lavi, who is the director of the Or Torah Interfaith Center. Aharon, thank you so much for chatting with us here on Chai FM and on the home run. This was a rare and courageous step. What made now the right moment to bring Iranian opposition leaders and Israeli members of parliament together and behind closed doors at that?
Hello, hello, hi, good afternoon. Thank you for having me. Well, I think, you know, the moment just presents itself. Meaning me, the Otto Interfaith Center and the Middle East Center, which is headed by my colleague Tom Wegner, we have been in touch with the Iranian opposition for quite a while. This connection wasn't made over the last 2 weeks. It's been for years actually, and we've had mostly people to people connection. We've done webinars and all kinds of Zoom calls with people from the opposition, with people from Israel. Some were public, some were more behind closed doors. But mainly our focus was people to people and less about the political spectrum. And we realized, actually, the initiative came from member of Knesset, Dan Iluz, who is a friend of mine. We sit together on a few WhatsApp groups, and we had a large meeting of Iranian opposition leaders and Israeli public, let's say maybe 4 or 5 days into the war. And he heard about it, and then he told me, you know, maybe it's time to organize something like this with members of Knesset. And, you know, it's one of those ideas that once you hear them, you say, how come no one thought about it before? like many innovations.
I have a lot of times that I think that. But if I'm allowed to ask you, were these opposition leaders, are they inside Iran or are they outside of Iran?
No, people on the core are outside Iran. We do not want to put anyone at risk.
Exactly.
Plus, technically, at the time of the war, as you know, the internet in Iran was pretty much shut down by the government, so it was impossible. They could send maybe WhatsApp messages here and there. They could not have a stable line to have a Zoom call, so it was impossible anyway. And also, we do not want, as you just mentioned, about the Jewish community. Obviously, there are many more people being arrested, whether they did something, whether they did not, and we do not want to be responsible for anything like that. So. But the Iranian opposition has very large wings or factions outside of Iran, because many people who are active in the opposition inside Iran had to leave, so now they live outside. You can think about it just for the Israeli public. Yeah, I'm here. For the Israeli public or Zionist public, this could be similar to a... Now think about the Machtavot, the undergrounds in early Zionism. So you had people here in Israel, but you also had offices and fundraising and other branches outside of the country before 1948. So these people have influence, they have weight inside the opposition organization, and they came from different factions. They came from both secular, Muslim, Christian, different parts of the opposition, and. It was a fascinating conversation.
What sense did you get from those Iranian participants about the mood on the ground inside Iran? Is regime change truly on the horizon?
Well, their sense is very optimistic. You know, nobody knows what's going to happen. Prophecy has given to babies and fools since the destruction of the Second Temple. But their sense is very optimistic. For them, the way they present it, and also, it's not only the people on the call. You know, we have WhatsApp groups with people from the opposition. We talk to them on a daily basis. They're 100% sure that these are the last days of the regime. I hope they're right. I think many of us hope that they are correct. But that's their sense. That's it. The tipping point has passed, and now it's just a matter of time, and the regime is going to crumble into itself or being toppled down by. There are different scenarios. Some people say that parts of the military they run a military, not the Revolutionary Guard. These are two different military forces in Iran. So the regular army, maybe parts of it will just defect and join the opposition. Maybe some massive demonstrations on the streets. Maybe an assassination of Khamenei. Like there are different scenarios, but as they see it, it's coming. That's it. It's irreversible at this point.
Aharon, the member of Knesset, Dan Iluz, who organized it, spoke of a shared enemy and a shared future. How do Israeli lawmakers envision rebuilding ties with Iran if and when the regime collapses?
What I think from the Israeli perspective, ASAP, as soon as it is possible. Israel wants to establish, actually it's to re-establish its relationships with Iran, because we had very good relationships until 1979. You know, there was an El Al office there, there were direct flights from Tel Aviv to Tehran, there were economic cooperation, academic cooperation. So I think members of Knesset in Israel, I cannot speak for the Knesset, but my sense from the conversation and other people I talk to is that the vast majority of politicians in Israel are interested, also vast majority of Israelis in general, are definitely interested in renewing this relationship. They see it as a strategic axis that could be, this could really change the Middle East. This could change, you know, world history.
Exactly.
From an area of conflict to an area of prosperity.
Did any practical steps emerge from the meeting? I mean, what might ongoing cooperation between Israeli and Iranian opposition figures actually look like in the short and medium term?
So yes, they came up with interesting ideas. First, I have to say that it's not just the present and the future. Before I talk about the ideas, one point that came up very, very, very significantly, and that would lead me, and I want to give context to the practical steps. People from both sides said, and primarily the Iranians said, that what they expect is something that goes beyond just polite relationships. They say historically that when Cyrus, you know, Cyrus the Great, 2,500 years ago, when he had his famous proclamation, when he gave Jews permission to go back to the land of Israel and rebuild the temple, so they say, and that's pretty accurate historically, they say he didn't just give permission to go back to Israel. He funded, at least partially funded, the construction of the second temple. He backed them up. So wow. They say the same way that Cyrus, like our ancestor, did it for your ancestors 25 centuries ago, we expect that once we topple down the regime, and they totally understand that it's up to them to take down the regime. They don't expect IDF soldiers to have boots on the ground, and they understand that Israel can do what it can do, but they have to do the rest. Mm-hmm. Once they're successful, they expect a relationship that goes beyond just regular connections, and they say, we want Israel to help us rebuild Iran, because you have the technology, you have the know-how, you have the resources. Just one example, water technology. Okay, Iran has plenty of water and rain in parts of it, but because of mismanagement and lack of infrastructure and heavy investment in nuclear facilities instead of civilian infrastructure, their water system is crumbling. They have droughts, they barely have water to supply to the citizens. So they say, we want Israeli technology, Israeli know-how, Israeli engineers to come and help us build a modern water system, okay? As practical as it can be. And the same goes for other food and science and agriculture. So I think that's the big picture.
I mean, that's really encouraging. I read that one Iranian participant proposed a future conference in Jerusalem. Is this symbolic, or do you think it could realistically happen soon?
I think it's realistic. I think, again, when he said it, it was another moment of, aha, like, how come no one thought about it before? Like, why did we have to wait so long?
All these aha moments.
Gotten, I mean, not right now during the operation, but we had years to get them on planes and bring them to Israel. Like, what's so complicated? They live in Germany, they live in Australia, they live in the United States, they can jump on a plane and come here. It's not so difficult, and there have been some visits, but nothing substantial as far as I know. So it was another moment of like, I should have thought about it myself, like all those moments. But yes, I think it's practical. We're already in touch with the relevant, I can't say exactly who, but the relevant figures in the government to make this happen. Obviously, we need to wait for the sky to reopen, to have enough flights. There are issues of funding, of security. But I think it's totally doable for them to visit the Knesset and have also a tour of Israel, you know, see some high-tech companies,
and
maybe
they
even sign
some
like
agreements.
Symbolic MOUs, you know.
Amazing.
Yeah, like...
Aharon, I wanted to ask you one last question before I let you go. Why do you think Israel, and not just the West, has a unique role to play in inspiring the Iranian people to rise up?
You ask me why do we have, or what?
Why Israel? You know, why does Israel have a unique role? Why is it Israel and not really just the West?
I think, and I'm going to be cautious here because we were like on public radio, and I don't want to, you know, bash anyone too badly, but the West, so to speak, you know, if you can speak about the West as one entity, parts of the West at least have sort of like lost. They've taken the wrong turn. They've lost connection. You know, like on GPS, when you take the wrong turn, now they need to like recalculate their route. There are even some protesters and some demonstrations on the West in Los Angeles and other places of, you know, like LGBT or progressive demonstrations for the regime, which is, it's just mind blowing. Like the regime executes, hangs LGBT folks. Like how can you support that?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the thing they see in Israel is A, the authenticity and the willingness to say about what's right is right and what's wrong is wrong, and the ability to distinguish between the two and not have this postmodern mishmash that everything is okay and everything is just contingent on your perspective and all that. No, some things are wrong because they're wrong, and some things are right because they're right, and in the middle, yes, to have a gray area which is more debatable, but you need to have some moral clarity, and I think Israel offers that to the world and to the West. We see it from the Iranian position, but we see it, you know, as the Interfaith Center. We have a lot of work with Muslims all over the world and Christians all over the world. And just this morning, I talked to a Syrian sheikh, yesterday to Moroccan professors. Like, that's my daily job. People from Pakistan, from Jordan, from many other places. And we hear the same message, that Israel has the courage, maybe because it doesn't have a choice, maybe because it just the other option is just annihilation. So Israel stands up for the basic values of the West and protects them. I think that's one thing. And the other thing, beyond the philosophical, position, it's also the willingness and the ability, not only the willingness and the will, but also the ability and the capacity to act.